Brigadier Calvert, Rail 3.
As I said, Winston Churchill said, under the circumstances, this is absurd. So I intend to send out to you all missions of officers and NCOs who have some knowledge of this form of warfare. I want you to treat them as belonging to you and use them as you wish. Now, as I see it, guerrilla warfare is a very personal form of warfare and is dependent on the character of the people fighting, their history, and also of the topography of the country in which they fight. So this form of warfare must be adapted to the circumstances with which you are faced. I suggest that there are two forms. One is defensive guerrilla warfare, where you're defending your own territory and you form guerrilla operations against any enemy who might invade. Secondly, there are offensive guerrilla warfare, where you establish a network of guerrilla operations in neighboring territories, so that you meet the enemy outside your own territories and you start up guerrilla operations against the enemy when he lands or invades countries nearby you. I therefore will divide up the world to give you your sphere of operations. Winston Churchill then divided up the world, which was typical, and gave each segments to each dominion and to the commander-in-chief, such as Hong Kong, Singapore, India, Aden, Middle East, West Africa, Bermuda, etc., all the way around, and Canada. And missions were sent out to all these places, and some just to do behind-the-line operations. They're varying size. And I remember at this time there was a grey-haired officer who'd fought in the 1914-18 war and who'd knowledge of all this type of warfare, and especially the IRA type of warfare. And he said, I'm certain this is wrong. He said, we've won our wars without doing this in the past. If we teach all these subject nations how to overthrow their governments and how to destroy armies by sabotage, it'll mean the end of all empires, and possibly the end of all civilization. And I thought him at the time, as a young officer, I was only 26 or so, 27. And I thought he was a silly old fifth columnist. But I always remembered his remarks and how true they became when, after the war, we were very often fighting the men we had trained. In fact, in Malaya, I was doing a reconnaissance of the whole place, and once my driver and myself, I was to write a report for General Harding. This is 1951-52, and we were ambushed, and my driver went into the ditch, and there was a hail of fire above us, and then we were lying in the ditch, and the grenade landed beside us, And the firing stopped and the grenade didn't go off. And I found attached to the grenade a little tag saying, "How do you do, Mr. Calvert?" And I think it was from one of my former pupils. So one can link up this time as to whether we did the right thing in teaching all these people. I'm certain it's in these books like Set Europe Ablaze and other things of that nature. This occurred in the book on SOE in the Far East. They didn't mention half the operations which did take place. Because I think now we're on the side of governments and on authority. And so we try and say, patriots and freedom fighters are villains and disgraceful people, whereas 1940, 41, 42, 43, these were our only methods of fighting the enemy. And in those days, we were heroes.
Who was the person who'd made this point to
I
you?
don't remember his name. He was a member of the War Office. Well then, so we were sent out on, they formed a mission of Colonel Mawhood, MAWHOOD, who was, had been MI6, myself and Freddie Spencer Chapman and two senior NCOs. One was from Small Arms School Deal, and the other was signals officer, a signals sergeant. I was given a very free hand to get what I thought we would need. Mawhood was given the rank of lieutenant colonel, but he had never been in the army and had no experience of it and didn't know the language. This he was a good chap, very good chap, but this turned out to be a handicap because when we got to Australia, and there we were with trunk loads of explosives and booby traps and things, and wireless sets, and the came rose up, but whether we weren't, the question came as to whether we weren't Nazis, and so we were suspect, and there was an inquiry into us by the Australians. The War Office knew nothing of our existence because it was secret, and we came under the Ministry of Economic Warfare. The Commonwealth Office knew nothing of our existence, due to some bad liaison. It was a time of change, where they were making changes in the cabinet. And for a while, we were under suspicion. I found this out by a girl whom I used to dance with, asked to see me, and said, "It's very vital." And I came along and said, "You're under suspicion." She said, "I drive the chief security officer around, and I've heard all the conversations. They say that you are not like the normal British Army officer. When one of the soldiers from Greece or Crete sees you in the street in your uniform, he says, 'Hello, last time I saw that uniform was in Greece or Crete. Come and have a drink with us, sir.' And I would go and have a drink and then stand them one." And he said, "That's completely, they don't think that any regular British Army officer would do that." I felt personally that it was the right thing to do. I liked the Australians and liked them ever since. The Freddie Spencer Chapman came from the 5th Sea Force, who wore a different tartan than the rest of the Sea Force. It's one of those anomalies. in the British Army, which they didn't know about. And so they felt that he was wearing the wrong tartan. Morehood said he was Lieutenant Colonel, but he didn't appear in any War Office thing. And so they were suspicious. But after a few weeks, she told us that we'd passed with flying colours and we were all right again. In my opinion, it's quite right of the Australians to suspect us. And there it was. And we got the utmost cooperation from the Chief of General Staff, General Lieutenant General Sturr Dee.
She took a bit of a risk telling you, didn't she?
Yes, she was very young, and they shouldn't have talked. But she wasn't a counter-agent or so on. I may say that I told Freddie Spencer Chapman, but he just didn't believe this. Didn't believe me.
What kind of a chap was Freddie Spencer Chapman from your personal experience of him?
He had been a great explorer, crossed Greenland on foot. He'd climbed up Chomolhari in Tibet to the highest point a single person had been. He came everywhere. He was physically very strong. He was a bit airy-fairy. He was very good in tactics and stalking. He taught us methods of stalking, which he'd done in Scotland. He was an intellectual, and he had tremendous charm, and all the ladies fell for him, and he was very, very good in society. He was... But he sometimes forgot that the main job, and a lot of other people forget, the main job of a soldier is to kill people. And as a guerrilla, you don't achieve anything by just being present. You've got to be somewhere near a target, and no regular force of any nation in the world is really frightened of guerrillas unless they can see the results in blown bridges or their friends being killed or ambushes, trucks being ambushed and so on. So guerrillas must operate. Now, in the last war, there are far too many so-called guerrilla forces which gave guerrillas a bad name. I mean, as an example, you could form a guerrilla force on slopes of Mount Everest, but there'll be nothing to blow up. You've got to have guerrilla forces somewhere near where there's a target. And there were cases in Burma, on the borders of Burma, and certainly in the Philippines, where, and elsewhere in Europe, where guerrillas just existed, or some of these missions just existed, were supplied by the RAF at great risk and did nothing. And you can rationalize the reasons for doing nothing in 100 ways. You say, oh, it'll bring death and destruction to the local population, or it will do this, or I mustn't risk my men, or I have no orders, that's the great thing, and so on. But people who operate in this manner behind the lines must be given directives, and they mustn't wait for orders, and they must operate. The directive would be to interfere, to stop all traffic down a particular road. Now, the Viet Cong, they had these sappers who were very fine guerrillas. This is in China, and they operated, and I understand the IRA have copied them and other people have copied them, in giving each guerrilla band a norm, N-O-R-M. It might be to blow up two bridges every 3 months or something of that nature. And then how they would do their own planning, They would ask for what supplies and explosives they'd need, and they would do their own very careful reconnaissance, and then they'd carry it out. Now, if they didn't carry it out, the commander was given a rocket. Second time, he was threatened, and his family would be taken under control by the communists from where they were operating. The third time, if he didn't carry out his norm, he was judged by by his peers, and they would usually pass sentence. Now, they wouldn't carry out the sentence. The guerrillas would have a force, rather like, I say, our military police, who would carry out punishments. And so he knew that he would be killed at any time. And so at that time, they would usually try and desert. And so when I was later on, when I was research, I got a research scholarship at Manchester University in guerrilla warfare, and I went out to where guerrilla in 1970, and I went out to in 71, to where all the guerrilla wars were being fought in Vietnam and Mozambique and Angola and Middle East and Algeria and things like that. I found this organization in practice, and I would always ask to meet prisoners, and there I would find people who had deserted from the guerrillas because they were under sentence of death. Now, to go back to what I was saying, that guerrillas, the SOE, were chosen and trained to operate. It's ideal if they can have another force, an extrovert force, to operate with them, because a lot of their uniformed force to operate with them on the organization which they have created. I use the analogy of a railway system which is static and supplies everything, and then you have the extrovert which remains silent, you have the extrovert rolling stock which operates on the railway system. So there should be a railway system of guerrilla organization in each country on which you can put people like the SAS or the independent companies and so on, and they would be told where to get their food, their medical, their information, intelligence, and so on. And this is the ideal situation. Now, there are people using this. The Indians use this in Bangladesh. They had the Mujahideen in there, and when they invaded, they everything was laid on for them. It had been done many years before by the triads in the great uprising in China in 1955 to 65. The forget the name at the moment. And that is how things should be organized. And this was one of SOE's jobs, was to organize a system of agents around to support the force coming in.
When you say that there were some of the guerrilla groups in Europe that were too inactive, which ones did you specifically have in mind?
I think one or two in Yugoslavia. And in some were dropped into, which were dropped into France, did nothing very much. There were, you know, the good and the bad, and same in Norway. And the ones in Italy, and the example is if they had SAS chap with them, they would operate and attack. But others felt they were chosen the wrong types. I had a second in command of the SAS who'd been long-range desert group. And he was a very brave chap, I'm certain, but he got quite the wrong atmosphere for the SAS. His main idea was sort of keep quiet, not make trouble. If you're going to go behind the lines, you must really be a troublemaker. And you can exist and do nothing. If it's your job, like getting out escaped pilots or something, or to get information, then is the time you do nothing and you just report back and you don't stir up trouble. That's why those people didn't like SOE coming in. But very often they mixed these two up, and you'd get the introvert, quiet chap, who was invaluable in his way and showed courage to a very great degree. But the type of person you wanted was the more the extrovert, almost the loud-mouthed boaster who would find he had to put his boasting into action. And very often they were very often good people. But you need both sides. You see what I mean? I say like the engine, hooting engine, and the station master whom you never see. And so you do need both types of personnel. And this, I think, is the lesson to be learnt in that way. And in the borders of Burma, there was this French, there was this American 101 group, which they were always trying to get in touch with me. They were up in the Kachin Hills, and there were very few Japanese there. And yet they have claimed having killed 40,000 Japanese, which was about 20 times the amount there were Japanese in that area. Same with the Chin levies. For a long time they did nothing, but they gained a great reputation. And in the Philippines, there were guerrillas who were actual guerrilla leaders dropped by air, who were actual criminals. And they, in the remote parts of the Philippines, they became sort of sultans in their own right. They had harems, and they lived the life of Riley. And they went on operating. They didn't give up when peace came. And they were operating for about 3 or 4 years after that. And the same thing happened in Vietnam. The original Green Berets, there were about 400 of them, were very high-grade people. And then that idiot McNamara, who was head of Universal or Motors, or whatever it's called, and then became Minister of Defense of America, he didn't understand the meaning of the word optimum. You know, up to a certain point, the more lorries you have, the more mobile you are. After a certain point, you get less and less mobile. Whereas the same with guerrillas. There's like an orchard. Each bit of country can only hold a certain number of guerrillas. Well, McNamara said, if there are 400 men who can do so well, enlarge them up to 1,600 and they'll do four times as well. Well, they opened up the recruitment and got some very bad hats in. And there were some people in, especially in Laos, amongst the Montagnards, mountain people, who became their own sultans, rajas, and made a dominion for themselves. And if you've seen the film Apocalypse Now, it's all based on this particular thing, where somebody is sent out to destroy and kill one of their own men who has become a Raja in his and thinking he was doing right in it. And so this is a danger of guerrilla warfare. It happened, I understand, in the Peninsular War. Is where they sent in most of the people. Wellington sent in some very fine officers, but one or two became guerrilla leaders in some remote parts of Spain just for their own benefit and not for the benefit of their country. And I say, this gives guerrilla leaders a bad name. Sometimes guerrillas don't understand why they're not given the kudos they feel they've earned. Well, it may be because some of their compatriots have lost that and go pounding around Wellington's headquarters like gilded popinjays, saying what I have done. And this brings a bad name onto all guerrilla leaders. I mention this because a lot of the army despise guerrillas, and the answer is that some are good and some are bad.
Right, now if we can go back
to the mission to
Australia, you were saying that you'd overcome the initial Australian suspicions of you.
Yes. Well, we first of all, we were brought to the Victoria Barracks, Melbourne, and where we had to make out war establishments, and there we fortunately had, when I was given time in London, I went around and I got hold of half a ton of plastic explosive, which was very rare in England, and I got 36 Thompson submachine guns, and I got some what I called hurricane sets off hurricane fighters, so they could operate from ground to air, and I brought out about 50,000 maps of all the islands, which were invaluable. And so we didn't arrive in the country barehanded, and we could equip what we decided were the best form of troops to operate were independent companies. These had operated in Norway, and they had a long history dating back to the 13th or 14th century of free companies in Europe. And we had an establishment which had been made out in Scotland. I think the total came to 273 men. And then we decided the training would be, the best training area is Wilson's Promontory on the southern tip of Victoria, just opposite Tasmania, because it had mountains, it had sand dunes, it had water, and it was remote, and it had an airfield. And I thought this is ideal because we hadn't got a definite place where these units would operate. There we trained a cadre of officers, and the idea was we trained them for 6 weeks solid without any